You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Football with Alan Shearer and me, Gary Lineker. No Micah Richards today for good reason, because we're talking about goal scoring. Today we have a very special guest. Like Alan, he scored loads of goals for Newcastle. Unlike Alan, he didn't turn down Manchester United, where he also scored loads of goals. So sitting alongside Newcastle's greatest ever goal scorer, we have Alan Shearer, and next to him, Andrew Cole, who this evening will be inducted into the Premier League Hall of Fame. And firstly, Andrew, thank you for talking to us.
No problem.
And secondly, many congratulations on what is a very deserved thing to be part of the Hall of Fame, which is a bit special, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think it's very special. I think for fans to be voting for you to have the opportunity to get inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think that in itself, regardless what fans think of you when you're playing against them, always change their mind when something like this comes about. So you're very, very proud.
Was it always goals with you? I mean, you made it look stupidly easy at times in your career. Was there always goals, was it, for you?
No, the crazy thing is that I think when I was at Arsenal, when I was a kid, they used to complain and say they didn't believe I scored enough goals. When I was younger, for me, it wasn't about goals. It was enjoyment, getting more touches on the ball. You know, doing a little bit more. And then when I gradually moved from, obviously, Bristol City to Newcastle, that's all Kevin wanted me to do, was like get in the box, play in the 18-yard box and score goals. So I just changed my game to do just that. You know, but like I said, younger, I always wanted to get on the ball and, you know, take players on and just get involved in all the open play.
That's quite unusual, isn't it? That way around, because I think most players start as, you know, wanting to score all the goals and have the fun and the glory, etc., and then probably drop back perhaps in their career if they're not that great at it. Whereas you were the other way around. When did the pleasure and the desire and hunger to score goals really kick in?
I think it's always been there. When I went to Newcastle, just the way Kevin wanted me to play, I think that's when it really kicked in, because I think we all know what Kevin's like when he comes to playing centre forward, scoring goals, running around. And he just drilled it into me, look, Coley, I don't want you to come outside the 18-yard box. So I think that kind of like flipped the switch. If you didn't want me to do that, I said, okay, that's not a problem then.
Okay, I don't have to track back and work
on it. Yeah,
I'll buy into that.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit like that. And I remember I played with Davy Kelly, and then Newcastle got promoted to the Premier League, and then he brought in Peter Beardsley. And for me, that was just, man, that was fantastic. You know, it was a great honour to play with Peter.
Well, the three of us had something in common there. So, we've all enjoyed playing with Peter Beardsley. I want to talk generally, not necessarily about, you know, career and stuff, but I'd want to talk about goal scoring. Firstly, that feeling of scoring a big goal in a big game. There's nothing quite like it, is there?
Not for me, no. Not for me. I think when you're working Monday to Friday, you're preparing yourself for the game on Saturday or Sunday, whenever it's going to be. I think you always run that through your mind. What's going to happen on the Saturday? What's going to happen on the Sunday? You're always preparing yourself to be able to score that big goal. And if the opportunity comes and you get it, I think naturally you do lose yourself, because that's what you do. It's the heat of the moment thing. You want to enjoy it, not just for yourself, your teammates and the fans as well.
Do you miss it? You said about there's nothing quite like it. I mean, the buzz is ridiculous. Is there anything that comes near that in terms of when you've finished playing?
No, I think we all know that. I think we all appreciate that. Once you retire, that is it. Everyone pats you on the back and says, thank you very much. You've had a great career. Not realizing you've got another 30, 40 years to live.
Yeah.
You know, as we know. But nothing will ever replace it. I'm not an individual who likes to sit and wallow in the past either. And I think for me, the only time I actually sat down and thought about what I achieved and the goals that I scored was during COVID, you know, because I wasn't allowed out. I was shielding due to my illness and that. And I think when the games come on Sky and end up just watching it, that was the only time. Otherwise, we've got to keep moving forward. And that's where I view things.
So in many ways, goals were important to you again.
During that time, definitely.
Yeah.
There wasn't much more we could actually do.
Yeah. How do you score goals? What's the secret? Have you ever worked it out? I mean, I think I did.
No.
No?
I think goal scoring is a bit like golf. When you think you've got it, you're on a bound run. And people say, oh, he's a natural goal scorer. I'm still trying to work that out. What is a natural goal scorer?
I think it's someone who gambles on areas where they think the ball might go.
We all gamble.
But that's it. Some knowingly and perhaps unknowingly. But for me, that is the secret. Whereas I watch a lot of strikers in today's game, a lot. And they don't do that. They wait to see where the ball's going to go. And then that's what the defender does anyway, and the defender's in a good position, so they don't get the chance. Now, obviously, we make run after run after run into an area, and often we don't get the ball.
Yes.
That's true, isn't it? That's true, I think. So then eventually, a ball will go into that area where you've made a run, and therefore you've made it ahead of the defender, and you've got like a one-on-one with a keeper or a tap-in, and people always say, yeah, but he did nothing all game. And there he is just knocking one
in. That's part of the job.
So I don't know about you, Alan, but I always felt like that in my career. That was the job, is just keep going, keep attacking space, keep attacking space.
I think it's very different. I mean, we all three of us, you would class as goal scorers, but I think we're all very different goal scorers, if you know what I mean, in terms of how we scored our goals. I mean, we always used to find that place in the box or the 6 yard box where the ball
often fell to. Well, you just whack him in from 30 yards on occasion.
Yeah, but we're all goal scorers, but I think different ones. You loved scoring from inside 10 yards and
I couldn't kick it any further.
So I enjoyed scoring them from distance, and I loved the ones as well. I mean, quick in my early day, but we're all very different. Would you agree on that?
Oh, most definitely. Maybe if you look at the rare goals that I scored. You know, I'd like to believe it was all different. I'm like chipping goalkeepers from the edge of the box. I think if people look at my repertoire of goals, would never believe that I would have scored those kind of goals. But I think when you're high on confidence, you do chance things, you do take things on that. Sometimes you try and say to yourself, maybe I wouldn't do that.
Did you end up being better than you thought you'd be?
I don't know, because you always want more from yourself. You know, when I retired, I actually turned around and said, could I have done more? Could I have won more? Yeah, because I always wanted more. I'm not sitting here saying I'm disappointed in what I achieved.
Well, you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
So, I'm talking about as you were young, did you surprise yourself how much you achieved?
No, I don't believe I did, because I was so driven. I was so driven, obviously, from my time at Arsenal. And then moving on from Arsenal, I think that really spurred me on, you know. So, yeah, I think I achieved what I would have liked to have achieved, definitely.
Boy, you could finish. And you had that amazing, you know, Keegan started your partnership with Peter Beardsley, which, you know, your goal scoring record. Funnily enough, it's interesting because I can relate to that, because my goal scoring record with England when I played alongside Peter Beardsley, it's a better ratio than any other time in my career. And I think I looked up at the statistics of your career today, and yours is better with Peter Beardsley as well.
Peter, for me, I've said many times, he was an individual, he'd get himself in positions and you'd expect him to shoot, and it squirts you to tap it in. I think me personally, if you've got an individual like that in your team, that's a special individual.
Yeah.
And I learned a hell of a lot from him. He was the first person ever to say to me, Coley, just stand still and you get yourself a couple of yards of space. And growing up as kids, you always told, move, be on the move,
keep moving.
And I did that. I couldn't believe how much space I was getting. I thought, oh, Peter's a genius, by the way. But he was, because what he was doing then, people are talking about now as if like the game's changed and all of a sudden, I mean, playing this number 10 position on the half turn. Peter was doing that when I was playing with him, what, 92?
Yeah.
You know, a special player.
I think you got, was it 34 in the first Premier League season?
Me, yeah.
Yeah, 34 goals.
With no penalties as well.
No.
a bit like myself in many ways. I never took penalties until I was 29. I couldn't get on them. Did you want to take penalties? Did you try and get... Because with me, it was just that it was always a good penalty take and they never missed. I couldn't get on the damn things.
No, to be fair, everywhere I went, they always asked me, Cole, do you want to take penalties? I'm like, no, not really. They said, you sure? Really? I said, no, I'm not fussed.
That's unusual for a striker.
I was never fussed. Yeah. I was never fussed about penalties. When I was younger, yeah, I wanted to take corners, free kicks, goal kicks, everything. And I think as I got older, I was just like, no, because I genuinely believe, and I said to myself, if you're going to be good enough to play at any level, you know, you have to score goals in open play.
Did you take any penalties?
In the end, I took two. Took one when I was at Fulham because no one wanted it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Really?
It was 1-0. I remember Clarky saying to me, oh, Coley, just take it. No one wants it. I'm like, Slim, I don't take penalties. He said, I'll just take it. If you miss, you miss. Just get on with it. So I took it, I scored, and we got another one the week after.
All right.
And I took it and I missed.
All right.
I mean, so that those are the only two penalties because people were forcing them on me, but otherwise, no interest.
It's really poor record, 50%.
How important is a partnership? You mentioned Peter Beardsley. I mean, you had an unbelievable one with Yorkie, didn't you, Dwight York?
York, yeah.
How important is it to have someone who understands you and you understand them?
I think I've been very, very lucky. Two partnerships that I never, ever had to work on. Peter, we've spoke about. Yorkie was just a breath of fresh air. You know, the way Yorkie played football, a big smile on his face, very, very clever. First touch was immaculate and strong, very strong. And I knew, just play around him, make runs off him, because I know if he got on the off turn, he'll slip me in, or we go wide and we get across him from Giggsy or Bex. But everything we actually did was all natural, because I knew what he was going to do and vice versa. So I think that's why it looked so good on the eye as well, because we actually knew each other inside out.
I would agree with that. I would say the best partnerships that I've had are the ones that it's just happened naturally. You knew in the first week that this is going to work. Was that something similar with you, with Peter and with Dwight?
With Peter, 100%. I remember Kevin calling me and saying, look, I'm getting rid of Dave Kelly. I'm bringing in someone special for you. And I'm like, I had a great time with Ned. He said, oh, don't worry about Ned. You know, I'm going to move him on. I've got someone special. Peter Busy turned that, and he was very, very special. Like I said, I learned a hell of a lot from him. Then Yorkie come in. I had to wait 4 or 5 games before I had the opportunity to get a game with Yorkie. And we played at the Old Dale. I think we won 3-0 in the end. Yorkie scored, I scored, and Jesper Blomqvist scored. And I set Jesper up for his goal. And then from there, it was one of those partnerships that the manager stumbled on.
At that point, you know, there was quite a few strikers, didn't they? Because obviously Teddy,
yeah, Teddy was there, and Ollie.
And Ollie Gunnar Solskjaer as well. So there's a bit of rotation going on.
There was.
Was that frustrating? It would be for most.
It was, especially when you was in a good run.
Yeah.
You know, and the manager would always say, oh, don't worry, I'm going to leave you out today, but you're going to play against such and such and wins and Champions League or whatever it may be. But when you're on that run, you want to stay in the team, but you kind of like got used to it in the end. I mean, it's not like today's game where the centre forward plays every single week, you know. Back then we had 4, could all play with each other, could all rotate, we could all score goals.
What was Dwight York like off the pitch? He just strikes me as a lovely guy, a fun guy. Is he that off the pitch as well as on it?
And energy is crazy, you know. In the dressing room, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You know, I think when you're in the dressing room, you got, a lot of male energy and it's a bit tense and that. York used to cut that, you know, just his meaner, laughing, joking, some of the things he used to do. You know, he cuts all that and then everyone's like on an even keel. He was big when Manchester United brought him. When the manager brought him in, he was absolutely massive.
Okay, let's take a little break.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids' session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Football with me, Gary Lineker, Alan Shearer, and special guest today, Premier League Hall of Fame inductee this evening, because we're doing this just before the event, which Alan and myself are both at and looking forward to. It's always a bit special. Sir Andrew Cole, and it's great to see that you'll be here for it and to receive. Do you get an award, Alan? You've been received. Do you actually get something, don't you? I can't remember. I've been a couple of times, but obviously, you know, and I know that you say, and I agree with you, that your career at times, I think you've been underrated and undervalued, but boy, at least football existed when you played. You know, for those of us that I missed out on the Premier League by a couple of months because I sort of finished semi-retired, went to Japan, didn't have the opportunity to play, so you'll never see me in this Hall of Fame. Not that I'd probably made it anyway, but it is a great achievement. What was it like? I don't want to talk about England a little bit, because obviously you didn't play that much for England, but mainly because of him, right? Mm-hmm. Shearer here on my left-hand side. Particularly at the point where he was struggling to score goals in that long spell, there must have been inside going, come on, give me a chance.
Yeah, I don't think I would have been any different to anybody else at that time. I remember when I was growing up watching England play, it wasn't a club feel. You know, people was picked on how they was playing for the respective clubs, and then it went from there. And then England became very much of a club feel. It didn't really matter what you're doing for your respective clubs. You always knew what the team was going to be. If you notice, back in that time as well, a lot of players were pulling out because they turned around saying, well, I'm not going to play. I'm going to go away for 10 days or whatever. Might be on the bench, might not be on the bench, but nothing's going to change. So I look at it and say to myself, people say, oh, was you disappointed with the England career? No, not really, no, because I think my England career was over before it even started. Terry Venables was the manager. I was at Newcastle. I wasn't training, but I was playing every Saturday or whatever. And I remember sitting in the room with Kevin Keegan at Maiden Castle, and David Davis was on the phone. And he was telling Kevin every reason why Terry wasn't going to put me in the squad. But yeah, I'm still scoring goals in the Premier League week in, week out. Yeah, I don't train Monday to Friday. I might train a couple of days, you know. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, well, things ain't going to work out for me, are they? You know, and it just went from there. And things just didn't work out.
Back to goals in terms of, have you got a greatest goal and a greatest miss? I mean, I always remember...
how he's changed the subject here. See how he's changed the subject from the fact that even though he wasn't scoring goals, he was still keeping you at the England team. Brilliant.
Well,
done, Alan.
He mentioned about scoring goals for your club. I was still scoring goals for my club. 37, I think, actually, in the season I never scored for England.
Was the part of you, Alan, that you used to think, oh, I'm coming in here, and like there's these great strikers, and there were great strikers around in that time. It was, you know, it was a really golden period, Fowler as well, and numerous others. But there must have been part of you thinking, Christ, I'm not scored for a while. I'm still getting in the team all the time. They must be really pissed off at me.
There was not one fucking part of me that felt that at all. No. Not at all, no.
You must have felt a bit of...
I knew exactly what the other forwards were thinking, and I'd have been exactly the same. If I was scoring, but I wasn't scoring for England, and someone was still being picked out, I'd have felt exactly the same. I'd have felt hard done by, like he did, like Robbie did, like Les did, like Wrighty did. I can imagine all what they were thinking, because I'd have been exactly the same. There's no doubt about it.
There you go. Now you can ask him that question.
What's your greatest goal and your greatest miss?
Greatest miss.
I always remember my biggest miss. I mean, my biggest miss was a penalty against Sunderland at St James's Park. So
I think you know mine. Another penalty.
I know yours, yeah.
Look, I think when you miss any opportunity or any chance, they're all bad misses in your head. That's the way we view it. But you see, I look at it this way now. I think as I've become older, when you say as a world-class goalkeeper makes a save, it's always the centre-forward's missed. It's not the goalkeeper's made a good save. So how's he a world-class goalkeeper?
There you go. That's an answer.
I mean, and that's the way I view things now. So when commentators, oh, and he's missed. Yeah. But yet the goalkeeper's world-class. Like, But if he's world class and a centre forward's missed, I mean, let's marry it together here.
Unless, of course, you've blazed it 6 yards over the bar. But
totally different.
Totally different.
So, yeah, I look back and I say, yeah, most probably the ones that miss it, that they all hurt.
It's the important ones, isn't it?
And you scored a few of those. And your most important one, or your favourite? Or
most important, they're all important, as you know. But most probably the one against Tottenham at Old Trafford, that takes us on to win the league. You know, we didn't play particularly well that day. And, you know, we need the win because Arsenal were very, very close to us. And if we'd lost, obviously Arsenal would have won the league that day. So, yeah, that was a big one.
I mean, we just mentioned the list of strikers when we were playing. Do you think it's changed now in terms of centre-forwards, more forwards rather than...
100%.
Yeah.
If you look, what's about now? And I do find it really strange why no one actually wants to play as a number 9 anymore. I find it really strange. Everyone wants to play a number 10 or...
Yeah. Even Harry Kane, who plays 9, he does love to drop deep, doesn't he, into that kind of
team. And sometimes, for me personally, too deep, regardless how many goals he's got, sometimes too deep, you know, and I'm still trying to struggle with this, the numbers game that everyone plays now, the 8, the 6, and all that.
I know.
It goes over my head.
It's all come numbers now, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it used to be midfield players and wingers and strikers.
There you go,
and
So when people say to me, he's an 8 or something, I'm confused straight away.
Even I know people would, because it's become a thing, number 10s.
Yeah.
Even when I played, and probably your time, it was he used to play off the front man.
Yes.
Or played a little bit deeper, used to play between midfield and attack. He would never be described as a number 10. And the weird thing is now, these are all given numbers, of course.
Yes.
Yet in squad numbers, they've all got like a multitude of numbers. They could be number 47 or number 86 or whatever it is. Yet people say he's a 6.
Yep.
When we played, it was 1 to 11. Certainly when I played. Was it 1 to 11 when you played?
It must have been. Black and white when you played as well, wasn't it?
Well, you played in black and white. You both played
both
in black and white.
Yeah. We both did.
Yeah.
Where's your happiest time? Man United?
I love my time at Manchester United, but I would never take away the fact that I enjoyed a great time at Newcastle. Regardless of all the nonsense that people have said and all that, I enjoyed it, but... For me, all the adulation.
What nonsense did people say?
I wasn't happy there.
Oh, I see.
It's just the adulation for me was like, no, this is crazy. Mm. I only play football. However, look, I only play football. You know, I'm no different to anybody else out there. And then when I first went to Newcastle, I remember Clarke saying to me what he's going to be like. And I said, no, he can't be that bad, Slim. Surely not. Wow. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. I'd go away for the weekend. I'd come back home and then... I have my neighbours knocking on the door saying, oh, Mr. Cole, your house is okay. Do you need any milk? Do you need anything like that? I'm like, I've only gone away for the weekend, you know. And yeah, it was very, very strange.
You didn't get that at Arsenal.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. I'm a young man. I'm still trying to find my way in the game as well. And I just thought, wow, this is a bit too much for me, this adulation and stuff. But as you get older, you kind of like get used to it a little bit more. But being in Newcastle is totally different.
Yeah, they're great fans. There's no question about that. Tell us about the treble winning season. That was incredible. Must be a thing of immense pride to have been part, very much an important
part. You can miss the FA Cup bit out if you want.
You never win the FA Cup, pal.
Fuck off.
Yeah, very, very, very special to be involved in that. Those last 10 days were amazing. And I think if you speak to the majority of the boys, the only thing we didn't do, we never celebrated like we should have done.
Why?
Because our mentality was the season after we go and do it again. You know, the manager was very big on you win, you move on. Forget about it. You got to keep going forward. And a lot of the players, that's what we brought into.
So you didn't really celebrate even after in Barcelona?
Barcelona, yeah. Barcelona was an unbelievable night.
Good. You know what I mean? I would hope so.
It was an absolute unbelievable night. But I remember we got back to Manchester. We went to the MEN back then, did a little thing there, and then everyone dispersed. Went off, had our holiday, come back for pre-season. That was that. It was forgotten. So we enjoyed it. Yeah.
That's footballing immortality in many ways, that, isn't it? When you pull off something that's so unforgettable, so memorable.
Yeah, because it changes lives, it changes careers, it changes perceptions. And I think just to be involved in it, like I said, those 10 days were so, so special. You can always look back on those things and say, oh, wow, I was part of it, just like many of us were.
Yeah, we've talked about Kevin Keegan, but I'd love it if you'd tell me a little bit about Sir Alex Ferguson as well.
Chalk and cheese. Two totally different.
That was what I was going to say. They must be so different.
So, so different.
In what way?
Managerial style, emotional style. As we all know, Kevin's very emotional, very passionate. I mean, Sir Alex, totally opposite. You know, he was driven, very focused on winning football matches. Whatever he said to you in the dressing room never came out. He's always very good in front of the media. He might give you a big dressing down, but he would never let anybody know. For Kevin, because he was such an emotional manager, he gave a lot away. I think when you're in that position, you can't afford to give a lot away as a manager because that transmits down to your team.
And a little bit like that interview that I kind of adhered to slightly.
Yes.
Breakdown moment, yeah. Really.
We generally thought after we did that, after Newcastle played Leeds that day, we all thought going in the day after, we won the league.
Did you?
Yeah. If we go to St. James's Park and we win there, we think Newcastle will struggle. And to be fair, Newcastle brilliant that night. Peter Schmeichel was unbelievable. But we get away, win it 1-0, and we always believe from then, yeah, we're going to win it. Yeah.
There must have been some spectacular fallouts with Fergie, though, over the years.
yeah. Yeah, there's some good ones. Yeah.
Any ones you want to tell us about?
Yeah, you know, I think when you play with a manager who's so passionate and desire and drive to win football matches and create history, you know, yeah, every now and then, of course, you're going to fall out of him. You expect that, you know. But what I enjoyed about him, you know, he was always fair. He give you a dressing down and then it's forgotten about. You move on, you know. And I think the majority of the players that he had at the football club, he would do just that. Yeah, sometimes he falls out with one or two.
Ruthless?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very. Mm. But when you're in that position, you have to be.
Mm. You think you do? I suppose to be in that job that amount of time, there comes a point where certain players are going to reach the latter stage of their career, and he was always, you know,
decision making.
He's out, get some new ones in. Did it many times.
He certainly did. You know, I mean, when I joined in 95, and you know, Ince was there, Kanchelskis, Sparky, you know, got to the end of the season, they were all gone. You know, and then he brought in all the boys in that class of 92, and as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah. What was special about that group of players at that time?
They could all play.
Yeah.
And I mean, they could all play. Their drive and passion to win was second to none. Obviously, growing up in the academy as well, they knew what Manchester United was all about, the fabric, the history of the football club. But once they crossed the white line, it was...
I used to look, obviously by that stage I'd drifted into TV and I used to watch Manchester United play. And of those young players coming through, I always thought out of the ones I'd want to play with, and entirely for selfish reasons, would have been David Beckham because of his service and his crossing ability was so sublime. What was he like to play with?
Bex, yeah. Wow. Yeah, worked very, very hard. That's what I loved about Bex, you know. His work rate was absolutely ridiculous. You know, you could never get him off the training pitch. Like he touched on, his quality when he came to crossing was fantastic. But another one, work ethic was second to none. And you marry those in, you know, obviously he played with Neville on the right there and the combination was bang on. Scholesy, for me, I mean, when I first went to Manchester United, Scholesy used to play in that number 10 position and ended up becoming one of the best midfield players that this country has ever produced. You know, so there was so many of them. Some of the boys that missed out, like players like Ben Thornley, you know, he had a nasty injury. Ben would have been... He would have been up there with them as well, definitely.
Mm, really?
You know, you mentioned earlier about your illness. How are you now and how are you coping and everything?
For me, there's good and bad days. There's a hollow leg day. I mean, you can't get out of bed. There's days when you got a little bit more energy than the other days. But yeah, for me, it's still trying to understand it. I work with it a lot more now. Before I was like, no, you know, I'm not going to be in a position where I can't get out of bed. But some days you just got to accept it. You can't get out of bed, mate. Get on with it.
Are you coping mentally with it?
Yeah, a lot better now.
The actual illness itself,
yeah,
I'd imagine.
A lot better now because I understand it a lot more for what it is, a fatigue illness. So whatever I think I could do, I mean, my mentality was, just get on with it, you know, man up, go to the gym, work hard and that. I'll do just that and I'll be sleeping for the rest of the day. And then you actually realise, this doesn't work, you know. But yeah, for me, I've said to myself now, what will be. You know, you work with it, you enjoy, but you've got to enjoy life now. You know, this is my second go at it, so yeah, I'm going to enjoy it.
Well, enjoy tonight.
Thank you,
Andrew. Look forward to seeing you receive your award. It's much deserved. Thank you very much for talking
to us. No problem. Thank you for having me.
Absolute delight. Thank you. That's it from The Rest Is Football from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye from me.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, US Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics US, brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, Was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.